This is an ABC podcast
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
It's good to touch the green, green grass of home.
Well, we all know somebody that is obsessed with their front lawn. Bright bottle green, not a blade out of place. The sort of lawn, well, you could play bowls on this lawn. Jono Kendall, the perfect front lawn, was it, do you think, a little more popular and commonplace in the 1950s and 60s?
I don't know. I think it's extremely popular now, and the pandemic has made it even more so because we just focused on what was in our home. We focused on our lawns and what we could do to improve it. And so that has really taken on a new life. And then social media, of course, has magnified that because everyone's looking at everyone else's lawn, thinking, how can I make my lawn look like that? Indeed, my mates from year 12 are still in touch, and we've got a WhatsApp group, and occasionally someone will share a photo of their lawn and everyone just goes, oh, how did you get that? That's amazing. It's so many people just love looking after their lawns.
And it really is an obsession that's taken life on social media well and truly beyond the pandemic. And even though we are still living through the pandemic, but it's been labelled lawn porn, those that are obsessed with their lawn. But I find it really strange, Jono, because I'm of a generation where it feels like, you know, it wasn't that long ago where we were living through drought and lawns were dust, you know, they were dirt. And anyone with a slightly green lawn, well, A, it was very rare. B, if there was, there were heaps of signs up to prove that it was recycled water or that it was grey water. And even then, I reckon a green lawn to this day sort of comes with a healthy side serve of guilt, I think, for many of us.
Yeah. Well, that'll be really interesting to explore today. If lawns are actually bad for our environment, because we love to cultivate lawns. We're in a perennially dry climate in Australia. A lot of our soils are kind of sandy and not the best for growing lawns. So why do we persist in doing this thing that essentially harks back to Europe? So why do we do that? And what should we do instead, Rish?
Well, and where are we at socially and environmentally with our lawns? Are they a great, healthy outdoor pastime, or are they an extravagance that hurts the environment? You know, whether it be from petrol mowers through to water use, we know that we need more green space to cool our cities and our suburbs. But as more and more of us build to the parameters of our blocks, you know, are we losing front yards and backyards? So is that having an impact as well?
Yeah, so that's why we want to know today, are you lawn obsessed? How much time and dedication does it take to have the perfect front lawn?
Or have you replaced your front lawn with something else? Maybe synthetic grass, fake grass, or food? There's another movement as well, looking at food, not grass. Do you think that lawns are an extravagance? Is the lawn a good thing or a bad thing for the environment?
This is the Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So how's your front lawn, Jono? Are people taking photos of it? Or?
No, they're not at all. Mine, very much middle of the range and full of kaikuyu, which a lot of people see as a weed. I actually don't mind kaikuyu because it'll pretty much grow anywhere. But it's not lawn porn worthy, if that's what you're asking.
Well, already plenty of texts on this. Synthetic grass adds to global warming. It heats the surface big time. So we'll speak to an expert about that today, who I actually think will probably agree with you there. And another from Jennifer saying every lawn should be converted to veggie gardens. So how do you feel about it? Lenny Lawler is the founder of the Australian Lawn Fanatics on Facebook. He's actually based in Brisbane, but you have had, Lenny, a huge jump in members since we started to live through the pandemic. How many users have you got on Facebook?
Hi, good morning, Rochelle and Jono. I think we're probably nearing 87,000 at the moment, I think.
And you would have seen a big spike during the pandemic, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think early 2020, we were probably around the 55,000 to 60,000 mark. So, yeah, decent jump. Yeah, 20,000 to 30,000, maybe something like that, yeah.
What is it about the lawns that people are talking about? Everyone loves to comment on a photo and chat about it. What are people saying? Like, what's the sort of general theme?
I think it's just a feel good. Like, it looks good. It makes you feel good. You want to take your shoes off and walk around.
There is something special about walking barefoot on grass, I have to say, albeit that there's no dog poo there. But
yeah.
Is there the novelty factor as well, that you're kind of making your lawn look like a golf course or, you know, a sporting field?
I think for some people it's a challenge, is to get the best out of their home and garden. And part of that is the lawn, not just the lawn, but, you know, nice flower beds, a nice hedge, the whole ensemble.
Have you seen a shift in how people think about not only what it looks like, but what they use? You know, there's lots of texts talking about maybe some of the chemicals that are implicated with attending to a lawn and to gardens as well, and the impact that that might have on dogs and other forms of pets. Are you seeing a shift, say, in your lifetime, Lenny, as to how people tend to their lawn?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've been doing the Fanatics since 2015. And even in that time, we've seen a huge shift in technology from fertilizer and herbicide and pesticide companies to be much better for the environment. Huge shift, yeah.
And so I would imagine there's a lot of kind of oohing and ahhing on the Facebook page, a lot of people admiring each other's lawns. But is there discussion around environmental issues and, you know, pollinators and maybe trying to use or reduce the amount of chemicals that you use, things like that?
Yep, absolutely there is. And we as the admins or the leaders of the group are pushing that barrow as well. The push from the governments towards the products manufacturers is to do more with less and have less impact. There's things like, you know, there's a pesticide now that will control armyworm and curl grub in your soil, plus a couple of other things, that has zero impact to anything other than targeted species. You know, there's things like that.
Lenny, did you come from a long line of lawn fanatics? As the text here saying, I remember my dad continuing to mow his front lawn even during a heavy downpour because he had to get an even surface. And heaven help us if we put even an inch of our tyre off the concrete when we were parking onto his lawn. That's from Martin. Is that kind of ringing, you know, memory bells for you?
Well, it sounds like Martin's dad was a lunatic. But no, not really. My dad wasn't really much for the lawn. I used to have to, you made me mow it, and I hated it. But I got a job working for the rugby club that I played for in Brisbane, and it was there that I really got bitten by the lawn, I suppose, grub, as to, you know, liking and loving lawns and making them look good and presenting a sports field that looked fantastic, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's probably where I got it from, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you and the group stand on Kaikuyu? Because that's what I've got at my place. Is that just...
Mate, look, honestly, at the end of the nuclear apocalypse and after the zombie invasion, there will be cockroaches and Kaikuyu.
That's true.
There's nothing wrong with Kaikuyu. If it's done right, it's a classic low-input lawn, so it's... You kind of hold a bag of fertilizer up and show it what fertilizer looks like, and then you put the fertilizer away.
You put it away. Yes, good on you, Lenny.
It's pretty drought tolerant. It's a good old-fashioned lawn, like you. It's hard to beat.
Yeah, that's right. Lovely to have you on, and lovely to have a chat with you, Lenny. I appreciate it.
No worries.
Lenny Lawler, founder of the Australian Lawn Fanatics on Facebook, and based in Brisbane. I've never heard that phrase before. Rich, a lunatic.
It's pretty good, isn't it? I love all these lines. This is another big area that we've seen jump, which is looking at, and this text says, my front lawn is now my veggie patch and I have my eye on the nature strip as well. And there's been a huge jump in people planting on their nature strips. You know, we always say check with the council first. You know, every council has different laws and rules. But another on text saying, my partner has created a front lawn full of indigenous plants and trees. It replicates the local bush here in Eltham. Sometimes I attempt to sneak a non-indigenous plant in and he pulls it out.
Yeah, this is strange, isn't it? And, you know, it's kind of against the law, actually, to let your lawn go and just let it, you know, turn into an ecosystem. The local bylaws are you need to keep your lawn at a certain level. You can't just let it go. Otherwise, it's a fire risk. Otherwise, you know.
But if you're growing natural plants and you're cultivating those plants and you're putting plants in and you're tending to them,
yeah,
is that against the law?
I'm not sure about that, but I know if you just let it go, if you just say, "Nah, I'm just taking a holiday from mowing," then
I think
then,
that's different though to putting in not having any grass as such,
yes.
and having all Indigenous grasses and whatnot. Which, you know, even those, they look like they're low maintenance, but they take a lot of work and care as well. We'll have a quick chat to Kaz in St Leonard's.
Oh, no worries.
Hi, Kaz.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What do you want to say?
Well, we downsized and we didn't even bother to bring our lawnmower with us, and we haven't got a blade of grass anywhere, front, back or sides. Now, the nature strip is totally in native grasses and low-growing native shrubs, and we've sculptured around it, so there's lovely waving lines of sands, etc. Every single person who walks by just loves it, and it's full of little drop tails and small birds, so we see it as value.
Well, this is what people say, isn't it, that that if you've got a lawn, you've kind of got a monoculture and you're deterring or kind of not making it as attractive for a lot of those pollinators, well, you know, bees and beetles and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes. And our backyard's even more interesting, again, with not a blade of grass but a little path winding through it, all out of natural stones, sands, plants, etc. And we've got little hides everywhere for all the animals that come in. Yeah. And we've now got two chooks as well.
Oh, isn't that incredible, just that on-flow effect. There's a text here from Jack in Hillside, John, and it says, I love my auto mower, silent solar-powered, and it's programmed to cut 3 times a week in summer, starting at 6 a.m.
This is one of those robo ones.
Yes.
Is it?
Robo mower. It must be. I've never heard of it before.
Because I've seen Terminator, right? And I know how this ends. Yes. And I'm not getting one of those. I'm not getting a robo mower. No, I'm not doing
it. It's like the robo vacuum. And I don't know if it's an urban myth, but, you know, it goes over poo in someone's lounge room and then manages to take it all the way around the house. But that could be an urban myth just to make sure that you vacuum manually and not with a robot. I have no idea.
No, I'm not doing that. Not doing that at all. Let's have a chat now with Craig, who is in Geelong. Now, I think you might be a lunatic, Craig, are you?
I am a lunatic purely because I'm an ex-golf course curator.
Right.
For many years. And my front lawn and nature strip, I actually cut with a 1920 quill cast push mower.
Oh.
And if it's done right, it's the most easiest thing to do. I very rarely fertilize, I very rarely water. And the trick is to whatever you cut off the grass, you put back in. So the grass cuttings itself actually start to feed the grass, because all we're doing is cutting the grass off, which is where the goodness is, and putting it in the bin. So you take your catcher off, you leave the grass cuttings on, and those grass cuttings mulch down and feed the grass. So
the push mower, the sort of, I guess, you know, what we're seeing some of that. I had one as well, because we had a tiny little backyard where there was only a tiny patch of grass. But I'll never forget going to buy it off this gorgeous older Greek man who spent about half an hour trying to show my husband how to use it, where we're like, don't you just push it?
The trick is the modern day push mowers are too light and they just bounce over the grass. Where the 1920, 1930s model quill cast, which is all steel, it's got the weight to keep the pressure down on the top of the grass. So you can end up making it look like a golf course green with the shade, as in the dark and light strips. So no petrol, no maintenance, and it's you just push it. There's no effort to push it, because if you set the cylinder correctly to the sole plate that actually cuts it. It's quite easy to spin it, it's easy to push it, and no noise, no petrol.
And just finally, Craig, how do you feel about women wearing stilettos on your lawn?
Not a problem. It aerates it. Love it.
Thank you.
Good on you, Craig. Thank you very much, Craig from Geelong. Let's have a chat with Fabian DeAngelis, who is a lawn fanatic from Melbourne's northeast. Fabian, what does your lawn look like?
Good morning. Good morning. Hi. Yes, listen, the lawn's looking great. It's looking great. It's actually a depressing time for us Victorian lawn addicts, because our lawns are now going to sleep.
Yes. Yeah. So it probably doesn't look its best at the moment. But how much work do you put into it?
Yeah, listen, it's looking good. Obviously now because it's going into dormancy, you know, we bring our heights up a little bit to protect it a bit from the frosts and all that. So it's looking good. And really now is a time to service our mowers, get our blades sharpened, get them cleaned up and, you know, just a little bit of mowing through the winter season to get ready for October, for when things are cranking up.
Where did your obsession come from, Fabian? Is this something that happened during COVID, or is it something that's been handed down to you?
No, I've got Italian heritage, so concrete's the priority in my background.
Right.
It's really just, really what happened is you finished kind of like cleaning up the home renovations and all that. And, you know, once all the tradies have been through, it was kind of like the next thing to do. And as, you know, previous people have said, you know, there's the online presence, there's, you know, more information out there. And you just slowly just keep working. And over the years, it's, you know, it gets into such a condition where it's, you know, quite easy to maintain.
Is there a growing sense of environmentalism within lawn lovers like yourself? I mean, are you starting to think about water use and chemical use and pollinators and deterring them, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, there's a few things, you know, like with the online things, you know, there's lots and lots of things now you can buy, because really it's kind of like a greenkeeper at home now. Right, like, so, you know, we've got a lawn that, you know, pretty much looks like a golf course. But, you know, there's advice that you've got to give and learn. You've got to follow labels. You don't go pouring out herbicides or even you know, fertilizers when there's going to be a massive downpour. You know, you just don't do things like that. You follow instructions. Once you get your lawn nice and thick, it actually doesn't need as much water as what people think, because you're covering the soil underneath and it's not drying out as quick. So a lot of people think you've got to be watering this every day, where really you might only have to give it a good drink twice a week in those summer months.
I'm wondering how yourself and other, you know, lawn fanatics are feeling about the robot mower. There's a text here from Matt in Geelong that says, finally cut lawns. Mine's great. Keeps the blades fine. It's good for trimming. Excellent lawn health. Cuts silently as long as I like. Excellent when you're on holidays to come home to. And Caroline's called us. She's in Melbourne. Caroline, not that we're promoting a particular brand here, but, you know, robot lawn mower. Yours even has a name.
Yes, well, it was actually in a holiday house we were staying at in France a few weeks ago. We called him Maurice because he'd sort of wander around the garden and doing the most amazing cut. And it was about an acre sort of field garden. And he would get as close as he could to the road and then stop, turn around, go back again and sort of going around and around. And we got a lot of enjoyment sitting on our balcony drinking champagne watching Maurice mowing the lawn.
Hey, it does sound like a good experience, Caroline, but I just because I can abide by a robo-vac, right? But any robot that has blades, I'm just a little bit uncomfortable around. Has Maurice changed that for you?
He was
sort of a whippersnipper and cut really short,
right?
And sort of cut it so often that it just stayed the same length we were there for 4 weeks, and it looked amazing. It was immaculate.
I think Jono, in that having something that's robotic with blades,
It's got a weapon. That's a weapon. I'm not comfortable with it at all. RoboVac, okay, you can do the vacuuming, go for it. You know, you might accidentally run over a toy. If you've got if you've got blades, what happens if you accidentally run over something? And I know I'm probably being a stick in the mud here, but that's where I'm landing.
Fabian, how do you feel about them? Are they a weapon? Can they come back to attack us?
I haven't done much research on those ones. There's a lot of, you know, I'm using electric whippersnippers now. I do have rotary mowers and cylinder mowers. I've got all those types of mowers, but I'm a fan of using a catcher. I like picking up all my grass. And just like with your car, right, if you washed your car, and obviously there's, you know, capacity is the issue here, but if you washed your car every week, it doesn't take you as long. right? If you mow your lawn every week, you can pretty much get around in 15, 20 minutes, you're done. It doesn't actually take as long, but if you let it grow longer, that's where you're spending a lot of time, you know, trying to hack into the grass and get it all. But if you mow every week, you don't have to edge every week. You quickly run the lawnmower around, it's done. It's, you've sucked up all the leaves, put it in the catcher, and it's looking good.
Hang on, how many mowers did you say you had, Fabian?
Oh, yeah. So I think it was a nine. There's a few more now.
Nine mowers.
Mainly from Craig, I think it was a Craig before, the cylinder mowers. So I've got a few cylinder mowers which I restore as a hobby.
So you're in double figures, is that what you're saying?
I am in double figures, yes. We all have a hobby, we all have our thing. So a lot of them are just I restore and bring back to life. So there's a lot of cylinder mowers out there, or the older style, which are much heavier, which push the grass and give you those lines like the MCG. You know, when you used to go to the MCG, you see those lines?
Because people take photos of your lawn, don't they? Like, it's next level.
Listen, it's really brought the street together. I've actually taken over my two next door neighbours' lawns. So they've said, please look after my lawn. So I do theirs as well. And they are wrapped. They bring me food. They bring me all sorts of things.
Oh my goodness, can you come and move in next to me?
People are walking past, you know, they compliment, they go, oh, we love walking past your place. Some cars slow down, you know, it gives us joy. I actually watched one couple have an argument once because the wife was saying to the husband, why can't we do this? And he was raising his arms in the air saying, no, I don't want to do it. And so sometimes it gives people joy. Sometimes, you know, some people come and ask you and say, you know, well, what glue did you use? I'm like, no, it's real grass. I didn't lay it. And but yeah, listen, it's all just a matter of getting it under control, getting your weeds under control, and the maintenance does come less. Once you got it under control, the maintenance is far less.
Fabian, thank you so much for your time. Fabian DeAngelis, who is a lawn fanatic, and as you can hear, he's got more than 10 mowers and loves his lawns, loves his mowers. But he says there is an increasing environmental awareness amongst lawn fanatics, Rich.
Well, that's interesting because lots of people are saying, you know, I think lawns have had their day. Many saying that they've replaced their lawn with food. Others saying, actually, I've replaced mine with concrete. It's easy to look after. But a growing number of people looking at synthetic or artificial grass. Now, that has changed dramatically. Yeah. And the jury is out from a lot of the community as to whether or not it's better for the environment or not, especially if it's at a playground, if it's in your own front or backyard, or if it's at on a sporting level. It's actually really divided a lot of communities over whether or not it's better.
Well, a lot of those new sporting facilities, and we've got one, it's a new hockey pitch near our place, and it's all artificial, it's all synthetic. I mean, there's no, and it does take a lot of the hard work out of it because on rainy days it doesn't get muddy, obviously, and you don't have to mow it or anything like that. But I did notice this during the millennium drought that more of this artificial lawn just popped up, and it did seem to be becoming really popular. I don't think it's really good for the environment, though, because the plastic just kind of breaks down, doesn't it? Anyway,
we'll get into that with an expert a little later on. I mean, that's the thing. I think there are two schools of thought. Well, Jock Gilbert is a landscape architectural academic at RMIT University. Jock, I guess let's take this back to the beginning. I mean, is Australia one of the few countries where we are obsessed about our lawn? Is this something that a lot of other countries follow?
G'day, Rochelle. G'day, Jono. Thanks for having me on. It's fantastic. And it's a great conversation that you're having up until this point. And I reckon you've nailed it a little bit. There are kind of... I'll try and continue that. There are kind of two threads, I think, that you've identified, and that's really great. There's this... And to answer your question, Rochelle, no, we're not the only one, only nation, but it does happen in a kind of lineage of where the lawns come from. So we can understand, actually, the lawn as being part of a democratic movement, if you like. So in America, you know, the lawn became the front yard space. You know, suburban America very often doesn't have dividing fences between properties on the front. So you've got this kind of green swathe all the way along a street, and that's shared space. So it is sort of seen as the kind of, you know, the apple pie democratic space. And then go further back, and the lawn in England and some other European traditions And the first public parks had, were inclusive, as was Central Park, which came from those English parks. But they were based on large areas of freshly mown lawn and highly maintained. Now, that's all well and good. About 20 years ago, an American author called Michael Pollan wrote a book called Second Nature, and he nailed the other thread here. So he talks about what he refers to as the egalitarian conceit of the American lawn as a puritanical expression of the ideal of shared neighbourly spaces and social progress. And that's a wonderful quote because it does talk about, exactly what you're talking about. It feels good to us. And it's interesting for us to reflect on why does that feel good? What is it about a lawn that, that makes us feel good, and especially that beautiful fresh cut?
Yes, it's one of my favourite smells in the world. If it was a fragrance, absolutely. I would buy it.
Yeah, that's right. It's like rain on fresh dirt. It's one of those things you just can't put in a bottle, isn't it? But look, he does make the point then, however democratic a lawn may be with respect to to your neighbours, it's in respect to nature, it's a very authoritarian step. And he uses the term, the lawn is nature under culture's boot, which is the other side of the spectrum. It is about control, and that's about controlling. It's the thing that we can control in our lives, which is nature. He also has a wonderful quote, the lawn is nature purged of sex and death. So we remove from our lives the cycle of nature. So, often lawn species are annual or can be annual. And, can die, they can flower, they have seeds, they set seeds. All of that is part of the natural cycle. So all of the soil organisms, all of the buzzing insects in the air are all denied the opportunity to, participate in that. So the lawn becomes what we call a monoculture. There's just one species and it's always green. What about a bit of death? What about a bit of procreation in the lawn?
So you, I guess what you're saying is lawns are bad for the environment. Is that right?
Well, then I can also offer another alternative to say that they're not, because we water them. And that act of watering, we can say, irrigation of lawns is obviously, in some camps, that's wasting water on what could be used for other purposes. Another way to think about that is that the watering of the lawn, and this is part of its appeal, sets up a little microclimate. So there's a little bit of humidity that comes off because lawns obviously evaporate water, and water evaporates out of that ground. And that's what starts to make our domestic landscapes and our close environment a little bit more livable in the summer when, the lawn is cooler. It's not only that it looks cooler, it actually is a little bit cooler because it's a little bit moister. So,
There's lots of text talking about that, saying more affluent suburbs are known to be cooler because they have bigger nature strips, or just nature strips to begin with, and that they have bigger front yards and backyards. But it's interesting looking at the fors and the against on both sides of whether or not lawns are good for the environment, but then sort of their role in our communities as well. So here's one from Lisa. She's in Carnegie. Mowing the nature strips around my house has become a part-time job. I mow five other lawns as they're all units and townhouses. They don't own mowers. I have two street frontages, so I do either side, out front and out the back as well. Also, my neighbour, who's two doors down, I do out the front. They repay me in curry. That's a win. Yum. Other neighbours often drop me wine or gin. That's from Lisa in Carnegie. But another here, who's in Ravenswood, just says N in Ravenswood. Rich and Jono, no lawn here. There's not enough water. We're on tank water in a rural area. We now have Lipia. I'm not sure what that is. It's a natural ground cover, and it's fairly tough, and it's better than the English garden style. So depending on where you live, you're going to have a really different opinion on whether or not a lawn is an extravagance or not.
I agree. And look, the problem with the lawn is that it doesn't depend on where you live. It's rolled out universally. And so particularly, we're bringing European and North American attitudes to a lawn, to a continent that doesn't have much water. So there seems to be an inappropriateness to that right from the start. And then you can break down into those demographic attributes and even down to the kind of suburban scale and those really fine-grained, kind of neighbourly relationships. There's a beautiful project happening in Melbourne at the moment called the Heart Gardening Project, led by Emma Cutting, and that is looking to convert or to take back many nature strips and start to think about how they become reservoirs of bees, bee activity and pollinators, so setting up pollinator corridors through entire suburbs. And that's a wonderful idea. And, you know, we can start to think about what we do with those nature strips in terms of the lawn as we can with what constitutes a lawn more generally. Another approach, a former colleague of mine, Michael Howard, used to talk about the idea of corduroy mowing. So you can mow strips and leave other strips unmown. You can take that one step further. Many, you know, if you go into Hyde Park in the summertime or many of the parks in Berlin, there are large areas of those that are unkempt. They're not mown. But Hyde Park does, engage in corduroy mowing there. So you can take your pick. You can sit in the long grass or you can sit in the short grass. Yeah. And that does
that's
also
such a good description. So I can just see corduroy now.
See, the tricky thing with that corduroy mowing idea, Jock, is that in some places, I mean, you can't just say on my roadside verge, I'm not going to mow because the council will come along and say, well, you've got a fine there because you've got a fire hazard. So it is, in some parts of the world, it is legislated. You're breaking the law if you don't mow, right?
That's very correct. And I think we become part of a world that is so regulated against risk that becomes a question. The Heart Gardening Project arose out of a local government authority telling the public that they weren't allowed to grow flowers on their nature strip. Basically, you know, it's a little bit more to it than that. But we are living in a world that is highly regulated, and the lawn, I guess, fits into that quite well because it's a one size fits all response. And I think, you know, what's coming out of the conversation is definitely what are some more place-specific, if you like, responses. Mm. What can we do that might, we can think about alternatives to lawn that might be lawn lookalikes, or we can think about complete alternatives to lawn, which might be food production, might be flowers for bee pollination, all of those kind of options.
And I guess we saw that, you know, didn't we, through migration as well, and when lots of different people, in particular the Italian and Greek community, when they settled in Victoria, you would see grow vegetables, not lawns. And for the first time for a lot of people, they were seeing tomato plants being grown in the front yard as opposed to this perfectly manicured lawn. But they were growing eggplants and all sorts of things that you couldn't, say, buy down at the local shops. Just finally, Jock, we heard earlier from someone talking about how they plant all native grasses and shrubs in their lawn, and you mentioned they're growing specific to your environment. Is that key, really understanding your soil and understanding what is natural to where you live?
Look, I think it is, and it's also your own resources in terms of time and money and you know, what taking into account what your neighbours want. But I think the native argument is now becoming aligned with our understanding of the people that were here before we all arrived as migrants. And, if we start to understand some what our relationships with Indigenous peoples are starting to have us understand about what our Indigenous landscapes might give us, and start to reintroduce some of that back in. So we've got a vast bank of Indigenous knowledge around Indigenous plants, both food and otherwise, and that might start to become more highly integrated back into our urban landscapes, so that we're cognizant of living in or on a continent that is quite different to North America or Europe. And we might start to find some joy in that as well, or more joy. There's lots of joy in it.
Yeah, yeah. Jock, thank you so much for bringing us some of these ideas of corduroy mowing, and I've really appreciated your time. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Jock Gilbert, Landscape Architectural Academic at RMIT University, asking us to maybe think differently about our lawns, because as we've been saying today, it has been, well, lots of people have been getting into manicuring their lawns. Lots of texts on this, Rish. This one says, mowing reduces habitat, sigh. Another text says, from Paul, says, we're not growing lawns in the deserts in Australia. Well, I guess in some places we are. I mean, you look at places like Western Australia, Northern Territory, Barrie, all of those areas in northern Queensland, there's some kind of desert-like scenarios, and people are trying to grow lawns in. They're trying to make them look like Europe.
And other people are ditching the lawn altogether and putting in artificial turf, and whether or not that is better for the environment or not. And there seems to be pros and cons either side. This synthetic lawns are a disaster for oceans and sea life. The tiny blades of fake grass break off and head down our stormwater drains. They head straight to the ocean. CSIRO identified this problem years ago, but nobody took any notice. I can't work out why this product isn't banned. And it's absolutely everywhere. What happens when people in schools and parks want to renovate, it will just end up in landfill. It's not a clever solution. It's a disaster. That's from Rosemary. And Jono, I dare say that Dr. Sebastian Fouch, who is an associate professor in urban studies at Western Sydney University, do you agree with Rosemary? Is it fake grass or, you know, synthetic grass? Is it not a clever solution but a disaster?
Hi, guys. Nice to be on the program. I generally think it has its place, but it's not possibly in parks, in backyards, more in indoor situations or high-performing sports where we've seen the use of synthetic turf for many, many years, for example, on hockey fields.
We just had a text from Rosemary, though, saying it's not the answer. Little bits of plastic break down and then flow into our waterways. So what do you say to that?
That's very true, and it's not just the little blades, but it's the rubber crumb that is used in sports fields in particular to weigh them down so they stay in place, and you can have a certain impact attenuation on the material, and that is a very well-known problem, not very well studied, not very well systematically assessed, but you just go to one of those fields and you see the little black rubber particles all around where just foot traffic disperses them into the environment when it previously wasn't there. So there clearly is an issue with the trapping and tracking of these various types of plastic that come off the materials.
Is it not a solution for some communities, say, where just green grass is not possible and you do need it, whether it be for a playground or for some kind of sporting field? Does it depend on where you are?
It does, and it also highly depends on the used hours that you actually want to get out of the area where you either have natural or synthetic turf. Again, there are debates. If you set up a natural turf field well, then you should get lots of use hours out of it without destroying it. Of course, a summer like we just had here in Sydney makes it very difficult when you have a lot of rain and it's muddy and it's soggy. That, of course, limits the amount of play on it. But if drainage, for example, is really good, within a few days, the field is ready again for use. One thing that we think is really difficult now in our densifying cities is that we are putting more and more people in, but we're not providing, at least in an exceptional proportion, new green space for these people to use as well. We want active lifestyles. We want people being in parks and enjoying the outdoors, play with kids. But if we don't provide enough of that space, then of course the little that's available, and we saw what happens during COVID when suddenly everyone rediscovered their local parks, they get loved to death. And that, of course, is a problem. They're then not aesthetically very attractive. It costs a lot of maintenance for local governments. And that's where you see that push towards then bringing synthetic turf in for at least sports fields and playgrounds. I wanted to mention, because you guys haven't mentioned it at all so far, not only the microplastic is a problem, but when it's outdoors and it's unshaded, it's also a real heat issue.
Yes, yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. Now, Will, in a moment, because we've had extensive conversations around urban heat islands and how we are, because of our built-up environment, we get very, very hot pockets of our big cities. Firstly, I just want to quickly go to Helen, who is in Mount Waverley. Good morning, Helen. What are your thoughts?
Hello. I have two questions about grass and lawn. One is that during a drought, a patch of green, and it doesn't matter what it is, can be a saviour for somebody's mental health. Secondly, it can also save your building, save your life in a bushfire. But in Mount Waverley, where I am, where we're suffering with the moonscaping of perfectly habitable weatherboard homes, the developers come along, leave a moonscape, and then go away. And what you get is, with rain,
waist-high weeds that then seed and go through everybody's gardens for 7 years. And that you do need to have some provision to make sure that that you're not suffering from an unneighbouring behaviour from developers and their ilk.
Yeah, Helen, you raise a good point. And I dare say this is something that you've looked into. Jono mentioned before that we have looked at different areas and where we're creating urban heatlands. And a lot of it does depend on the suburbs. I know Clayton is one area that was studied quite heavily because it was rising. Its heat was rising far. It was far hotter than a lot of other suburbs. In the work that you've done, does it sort of depend on where you're at and how much development there is, like Helen in Mount Waverley just said, and she's got concerns for her community?
Yes, it's the way that we're transforming our peri-urban landscape from something that is most of the time green, could be pasture, could be wooded, to hardscapes. Then, of course, the various types of houses using materials that also add to the heat, plus you're introducing human activities, you introduce traffic, air conditioning systems that spew hot air into already hot environments. So the whole heat balance that you see changing from peri-urban, mostly impervious, as I said, green surfaces to pervious surfaces, hardscapes, buildings, and then, yeah, all the human activity contributing as well to making it hotter. And we're not really well on top of all of that with keeping the water inside to actually keep cooling through plants that can transpire lots of water and therefore reduce air temperatures. So it's a vicious cycle.
And does synthetic grass contribute to urban heat islands, or does it take away some of that heat?
You have to think at different scales here. So the urban heat island, either for surface heat or air temperature, is working at a very large scale, but it's also working at a micro scale around your own home. So when you put synthetic grass around your home, then you make your house hotter. That means you will need more energy to cool your house down, because you're storing and re-radiating more heat into your microclimate around your house. When you think of you're the only one in your suburb that has installed synthetic lawn around your house, you probably don't change the suburb climate much. I would say you probably don't at all. So there's a matter of scale here too.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's one for actually having a lawn, or even better, having, you know, a plant and a specific garden, or an appropriate garden. Anne is in Melbourne. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that synthetic lawns are a disaster. There can be no photosynthesis with a synthetic lawn. All it's doing is preventing natural grasses and shrubs from being part of nature. The synthetic lawns will destroy all our underground ecosystems. How can we have a balanced ecosystem which photosynthesizes and stores carbon if we've got synthetic lawns?
Is it better then, and thank you, I'll put this back to Dr. Sebastian Fouch, is it still better than, say, concrete? Some people are saying, well, I'm putting in concrete, but a lot of people don't have time to tend to lawns, or they mightn't have the space or the resources. Is it, you know, I'm not saying that either are great, but is it better than concrete or some kind of tile or stone in your backyard?
So there are still pervious surfaces that are similar to concrete. You even use them in your driveway if you want to open up the surface. So just a concrete slab is, of course, bad. I would say equally as bad, if not worse, is AstroTurf. I don't want to rate the two because they have pros and cons. All materials have. But I agree with Anne that there are so many additional impacts that we don't even have, from a scientific perspective, the actual understanding of what it does, for example, to the soil microbe environment. When we cover our garden, our back garden, with AstroTurf, A, it becomes hotter, so the topsoil becomes hotter, and B, it doesn't have the same rates of gas exchange anymore. So there are add-on effects to all those critters that live on the soil that we don't even understand because nobody has systematically studied it.
So synthetic grass is coming out looking pretty bad after this conversation, I've got to say, Dr. Sebastian. Let's have a chat with Helen, who is in St. Albans. G'day, Helen.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, go ahead.
We have a project called Seeds from the Streets, and we ask people to, we plant in nature strips and gather up seeds to put back into our native grasslands.
And how's it been going? What sort of popularity has it got?
Good. We've got some really dedicated people that have these great harvests every year, and we've done some seeds from schools and doing different things and trying to engage with the community to understand about the benefits of our remaining grasslands.
What sort of seeds do you collect?
So we have plants that belong in our Indigenous grasslands that are located in Western Melbourne. And so things that are, some of them that are highly endangered and some of them that are fairly common. So there's pretty bluebells and there's highly endangered button wrinkleworts that, you know, people can grow on their nature strip.
And we're hearing more and more communities sort of working together to do things like that. Good on you, Helen. There's a text here from Rose that says, oh, I'm so loving this conversation. My children's primary school put in a synthetic oval. The black rubber particles were constantly finding their way into our lounge room. I thought we had mice at first. Also, as a lawn, nature strip is better than none. Just around the corner from our house, a new house keeps taking up most of that corner block. It's been built, and instead of reinstating the two nature strips, the new owner has replaced them both with gravel mix on both sides, apart from looking horrible, but it's noticeably hotter as I walk past there. That's from Rose. Sebastian, I mean, what sort of rules does it come to with redevelopment? Time and time again, when we have conversations like this, it will come back to development and to mid and to high density building. Are there rules around whether or not you can replace a lawn with gravel mix or synthetic turf?
No rules, but also no really good recommendations for people doing this work. My whole work is centered around urban cooling, trying to get our cities you know, being prepared for the next decades where we know that temperatures will rise, air temperatures will rise, we will have more heat waves, they will be longer and more intense. We need to prepare for that. And we need, because some of these measures take years to actually become effective, like planting trees. So we need to take action now. And it's very sad to see not only the new developments locking us in basically for the next 50 years with a lot of heat, but also the retrofitting is not really informed of how do we not only keep cool, but also how do we reduce the amount of air conditioning that we will need to sustain, let's say, multi-story apartment blocks to be livable habitats in hotter futures.
Yeah, that's right. And this is urban heat island effect that we've spoken about previously. John in Mornington says, as a council town planner, we have resisted synthetic lawns in landscape plans for years. What's next? Plastic trees? Although Alan in Carrum has a bit of a different opinion. Morning, Alan.
Good morning. I live in Carrum and I've had synthetic grass on a patio, it's an upstairs patio, for 7 years. I've not only found that the patio is much cooler, but it stops the reflection of the sun into my living area. I face west. So in my case, the synthetic grass has been a cooling effect, not only where the grass is, but also on the house itself.
Almost using it like a carpet on a patio area. That's interesting, Alan, because I've actually, some of our best mates have put in synthetic turf up the back because they had a couple of rescue or have a couple of rescue greyhounds that just pull up their grass all the time and the kids weren't using the backyard. So even though they're very big environmentalists, they've got it there and they find that the kids are using the backyard more, they're out together as a family more and playing basketball and using the backyard in the way a backyard should be used. So I can sort of see both sides there too. Backyard that doesn't get used, backyard that does get used. It's tricky, isn't it, Sebastian?
It is tricky. There is no silver bullet solution here. Also, what we see in Western Sydney, and you would see the same also in Western and Northern Melbourne, in the new suburbs, a lot of the properties are rental properties and you don't want to have additional cost as an owner when you're not guaranteed that your tenants will actually look after the nicely manicured garden. And that's a motivator to put in synthetic turf, because then you don't need to worry about weeds and overgrowth and, you know, just visually a deterioration of your property. So there are, of course, arguments for it. I can only come from the science perspective and say, for example, in playgrounds, it's the hottest material that I can find. It's consistently the hottest, with up to 90 to 95 degrees Celsius surface temperature. And that, of course, creates radiated heat. And that means kids playing on these surfaces get really hot much quicker if it's not shaded. Once it's shaded, these temperatures won't happen. But the problem is that we don't have enough shade in our playgrounds.
Don't get me started on not enough shade in playgrounds. Yeah. Dr. Sebastian Fouch, Associate Professor in Urban Studies at Western Sydney University. Thanks so much for your time. And Jono Kendall, as you mentioned earlier, we have done similar shows to this on heating and cooling our cities and our suburbs and our towns. Go back through the Conversation Hour feed if this is a topic that you're interested in, and there's multiple shows on it.
Yes, that's right. And I just want to shout out to all of the land care groups across Victoria. They're probably listening to this, either shaking their head or nodding their head, because they do think a lot about grasses, in particular those native grasses, wallaby grasses and kangaroo grasses. And they put out books too. There's in East Gippsland, there's one called Pasture Grasses of East Gippsland. Very, very handy, Rish.
Absolutely. And if this is something you want to make comment on, don't forget we've got an email address. You can email conversationhour@abc.net.au. And if you want to go back and listen, we do have a pod. Every show, every day is put up. Just search Conversation Hour and you can go through the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and those daily programs will be there. Jono, as always, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
This has been the Conversation Hour. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to spending time with you soon.